This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This is Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from What I Came to Tell You by Tommy Hayes. He was surprised his father had remembered the waltz, which was tomorrow. He himself had all but forgotten. Still, every sixth grader had to attend. Although he wasn't a big fan of shopping, shopping for clothes with his father had always been less painful. His father would take him to a store, let him try on a few clothes, and then buy whatever Grover liked. There was no driving around to five different stores and trying on every shirt or pair of pants or shirts or shoes in his size in the city of Asheville. There were no female hands fluttering over him, tugging his pants, straightening his collar, pushing the hair back out of his face. There were no frowning sales ladies. Grover missed many things about his mother, but shopping with her was not one of them. Grover and his father walked the few blocks to Berkowitz's, a men's store where his father had always bought clothes, but this was the first time Grover had gone there to buy clothes for himself. It made him feel like he was entering a kind of club. The bell rang when they walked in, and Mr. Berkowitz came out of a back room. Bald, with wild, bushy eyebrows and a yellow tape measure always hanging around his neck, Mr. Berkowitz had been in business downtown for almost 50 years. What impressed Grover most about Mr. Berkowitz was that he drew his own ads that ran in the Asheville Citizen Times. He sketched coats, shirts, ties, and pants. "Grover's going to the Christmas waltz," his father said. "Ah, the Christmas waltz," said Mr. Berkowitz. Looking over his glasses at Grover, "Are you taking a girl?" Mr. Berkowitz pronounced girl like Goyle. Grover shook his head, his face on fire. "And he needs a coat," his father said. "Ah, a jacket," Mr. Berkowitz said. "Where I'm from, it's a jacket. Down here, it's a coat. Either way, Grover, we'll find a nice one that'll have the girls lining up." Without asking Grover's size or even lifting the tape measure from around his neck, Mr. Berkowitz ran his fingers along the rack, slipped a coat off its hanger, and held it out for Grover to try on. A gray tweed coat. Grover's father sometimes wore tweed. Grover pushed his arms through the silky lining of the sleeves. Then Mr. Berkowitz buttoned the buttons, and Grover stood in front of the mirror with his father and Mr. Berkowitz behind him, all three looking at the coat. It fit. "You're a wizard," his father said to Mr. Berkowitz. "When the boy is ready for the jacket," said Mr. Berkowitz, "the jacket is ready for the boy." Mr. Berkowitz tugged on the sleeves, patted the shoulders, and then said, "What do you think, Grover?" "I like it," he said. "He sounds surprised," Mr. Berkowitz said, turning to his father. He was surprised. Looking at his reflection in the mirror, he appeared different. Bigger, older, more solid. The coat itself, the form of it, the weight of it along his back, across his shoulders and down his arms, made him feel stronger and more grown up. Mr. Berkowitz had him try on pants that went with the coat and pinned the cuffs. He picked out a shirt and a tie that would go with the coat. He promised he'd have the pants ready by tomorrow. His father carried a bag with Grover's shirt and tie, and Grover carried the coat, which came with a nice plastic protector with a zipper on it. They rode the bus home. Grover hung the coat on the handhold above his seat and watched it sway with every turn the driver made. He looked at his watch. The whole thing had taken half an hour. "Why did Mama always take so long to shop?" he asked his father. "To women," his father said, "it's not the clothes as much as it is the process of shopping for them." "I don't get it," Grover said. "Case in point." His father raised his finger like he'd been waiting for this question. "When your mother and I were about to marry, we drove to a mall to shop for a dress for the reception. The first store, she tried on a red silk dress that looked stunning. I assumed we could buy it and leave." His father looked at him. "I was woefully undereducated in the ways of women." "You didn't buy the dress?" "Your mother insisted that we look at every other store in the mall. She must have tried on close to 100 dresses. None came close to that first dress, and she knew none would. She continued trying on dress after dress. 10 stores, and 5 hours later, we returned to the first store, exhausted. Or at least I was. Only then was she ready to buy the red dress." "Why did you have to go through all that?" Grover asked. "That's what I ask her." "What did she say?" "She said it would have been too easy." "You mean, if she had bought the dress when she first tried it on, she wouldn't have liked it as much?" "Exactly. The worth of that dress increased with every other dress she tried on." "But she ended up buying the same dress," Grover said. "Oh, but it wasn't the same dress," his father said. "It wasn't?" "Not to your mother. To her way of thinking, by trying on all the other dresses, she transformed a dress into the dress." His father's voice cracked a little. "And I have to admit, she was right. It was the dress. She was stunning." His father was quiet for a moment. He put his hand on Grover's knee. "I wish you could have seen her." Grover stood in a clump of sixth-grade boys who tugged on their ties, glanced uncertainly across the gym at a clump of girls, and then out toward no man's land. Daniel and Sarah, a girl in Miss Shook's class, along with 2 or 3 other brave couples, waltzed around the gym floor. The glaring overhead gym lights had been dimmed, and lamps with warm yellow shades had been set up around the edge. Christmas lights crisscrossed the ceiling. Mr. Godleski, a second-grade teacher, had his bluegrass band, Buncombe Turnpike, set up on the stage. A short, fat man played fiddle, a horse-faced man played the electric piano, and Mr. Godleski stood next to them, plucking his bass fiddle. All three wore coats and ties. At one end of the gym, a large table had been set up with cookies, cakes, and brownies PTO parents had made. Next to that table, Miss Snyder, in a black, tight-fitting dress, stood behind the punch bowl, ladling punch into cups. "Miss Snyder is hot," Sam said, coming up to Grover. "And why aren't you dancing?" "Why aren't you?" "You know why. Ashley doesn't own you." "I know that," Sam said, "but I'm not sure she knows that." Then he said, "Look who's coming." Mira crossed the gym floor, wearing a long white dress, a pearl necklace, and pearl earrings. She looked to Grover like some African princess. "Hi, Grover," Mira said. "Hey, Sam." Grover wanted to say something about Mira's dress, but was in a kind of trance just looking at her. "You look nice," Sam said. "Thanks," Mira said. She turned to Grover. "I love your coat." "It's tweed," Grover said, putting his hands in the coat pockets. Mira nodded, then crossed her arms and looked out at Daniel and Sarah dancing. Sam gave Grover a nudge and nodded toward Mira. "They sure are good dancers," Mira said. Sam nudged Grover again. "Mira," Grover said hoarsely, "want to dance?" "I thought you'd never ask." She reached for Grover's hand and led him onto the dance floor. "The only thing is," Grover said, "I don't know how." "Grover Johnston," Mira said, putting her hands on her hips, "don't tell me that after all those lessons you don't know how." For the past 2 months, Mrs. Brown had devoted 10 minutes of every gym class to practice waltzing. Since the classes were divided into boys and girls, boys had to waltz with boys and girls with girls. "Listen to the music," Mira said. "Let's stand here and count for a minute. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Count with me." 1, 2, 3, Grover began. 1, 2, 3. He glanced back at the clump of boys watching and saw Ashley lead Sam onto the dance floor. Mira placed Grover's hand on the small of her back and took his other hand, and they began to move around the room. 1, 2, 3, Mira kept saying. 1, 2, 3. They danced stiffly and stepped on each other's toes. "I think we're taking too big of steps," Grover said, remembering Mrs. Brown saying something about that. They started taking smaller steps, and as soon as they did, they began dancing better. Grover kept getting off the beat. Mira would stop them, make him count with her again, and then they'd start again. "We're supposed to look into each other's eyes," Mira said. "We'll run into people," Grover said. "Mrs. Brown says if you look into the girl's eyes, you'll always know where you're going. Trust me." He looked her in the eyes, and as soon as he did, they ran right into a couple. "Let's try again," Mira said. They ran into another couple. "I don't think you're really looking into my eyes," she said. This time, he kept his eyes on hers, and it was the strangest thing, but it was just like she said. As they circled around the room, Grover could sense where they were going, yet he never looked away from her soft brown eyes. With each time around the gym, Grover felt they were getting the hang of it. They were going faster and dancing smoother. He tried to glance around the room, and as soon as he took his eyes off Mira's, they ran into Ashley and Sam. "Watch where you're going," Ashley frowned. "We ran into them," Sam said to Ashley. "I'm sorry," Ashley said to Mira. "Sam is such a terrible dancer." "Me," Sam said. Before he could say anything else, Ashley waltzed him away. Mira and Grover circled the gym a couple more times. When it was over and they walked off to the side, Mira said, "You're a good dancer." They stood there a moment, smiling at each other. As Mr. Godlewski's band started into another song, Tim Buchanan asked Mira to dance. Off they went, spinning across the dance floor with the growing crowd of waltzers. Mrs. Dillingham moved through the crowd like a shark through a school of fish, keeping an eye out for misbehavior. Someone tapped Grover on the shoulder. He turned around, and standing there was this beautiful girl who looked vaguely familiar. "Hey, Grover." "Emily, is that you?" She had her hair up and wore some old-fashioned-looking dangly earrings with purple stones that caught the light. She still had her coat on. "You already forget me, Grover? It's just your hair and all is so..." "Is so what? How do you get here?" "Mama, she and Clay went Christmas shopping downtown." She laid her hand on his sleeve. "I like your coat. You and Mira waltzed nice together." "The trick is to look into the person's eyes," Grover said. His and Emily's eyes met for a second. Then they turned back, watching the waltzers. Grover guessed most of the boys had discovered by now that dancing with girls was a lot better than dancing with sweaty boys in gym class. When the waltz was over, Ashley and Sam stopped right beside Grover and Emily, as if Ashley had planned it that way. "Hey, Emily," Sam said. "You made it. You look great." Ashley narrowed her eyes at Sam, then turned to Emily. "How nice of you to come," she said, like this was her house. "I love your hair up like that. Shows off your bone structure." Grover couldn't tell if Ashley meant it. From the way Emily kept her eye on Ashley, Grover knew Emily couldn't tell either. "Love the earrings, too," Ashley said, stepping up and slightly lifting one of them to see it better. "Are they costume?" Emily took a step back. "They're my Nana's, and they're real amethyst," she said, touching them protectively. "Aren't you burning up in that coat?" Ashley asked Emily. "We'd like to see your dress." Emily looked at the floor. "It's just an old dress my Nana gave me." "I'd love to see it," Ashley said. "I love vintage." "Leave her alone, Ashley," Sam said. "I want to see her dress is all," Ashley said. "Is that so terrible?" "If she doesn't want to take her coat off," Sam said, "that's her business. Come on, let's waltz." "But," Ashley began. "I said let's waltz," Sam said, in the firmest tone Grover had heard him use. Even Ashley looked surprised. As the music started, he pulled Ashley onto the dance floor. Emily glared as they moved off into the crowd of dancers. "Don't pay her any attention," Grover said. "She's jealous." "Of what, Grover?" Emily's face flushed angrily. "Some redneck mountain girl who wears her grandma's old dress to the school dance?" "She's jealous of the smartest, prettiest girl at the Isaac Claxton Elementary Christmas Waltz." Grover rubbed his forehead. "I can't believe I just said that." "You didn't mean it?" Emily asked, her mouth still set angrily. "Oh, I meant it," Grover said. She studied him, then slowly smiled. "Want to dance?" Grover asked. "Okay," she said. She hesitated as she started to unbutton her coat. "You can dance with your coat on," Grover said, "if you want." "It's as hot as Hades," she said, finishing unbuttoning her coat. "Would you help me off with this?" Grover took her coat, draped it over one of the folding chairs against the wall. She wore a wine-colored velvet dress that shimmered in the low light. Grover had never known that a dress could be deep, but that's what it was. It had a reddish luster, the color of glowing coals. And the way Emily had her hair up, her dark cheeks, her neck, and the curve of her chest, all somehow picked up the luster of the dress, making her look lit from within. There was a word for being lit from within. They'd studied it earlier in the year, but he couldn't remember it. All he knew was that the dress fit her in a way that made her more curved, like she'd grown 10 years in the couple of weeks she'd been away. Heads already turned, Grover and Emily walked out onto the dance floor. Grover took her hand and then put his other hand on the small of her back, like Mira had shown him. His hand sank into the soft velvet, and he could feel the hardness of her backbone beneath the tips of his fingers. He looked her in the eye. "Daddy used to waltz with me when I was a little girl," she said. "He used to put on this old song called the Tennessee Waltz, and he'd waltz me around the front room with me standing on the tops of his feet. All I had to do was hang on." Grover began counting out loud to the music. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Then they started, waltzing, stiff at first. They stopped in the middle of the dance floor. "I'm sorry," Emily said. Daddy used to do all the work, I guess. Look me in the eye. Grover counted again, and then they stepped off. They went slower than he and Mira had, but it wasn't long before the stiffness gave way to a floating feeling. The longer they danced, the more Grover could guide them around couples without looking away from her. It was strange how that worked. By looking deep into someone's eyes, he could see the world around him. The more they danced, the more Grover forgot the dancers on the dance floor, the musicians on stage, the parents and teachers serving food and drinks. As they circled and swayed, Grover felt alone with Emily. They danced their way into a stillness Grover had never known before. It wasn't till the waltz was over and he looked around that he realized people had stopped dancing to watch them. He saw Ashley and Sam on the edge of the crowd. Sam grinned. Ashley looked miserable. They'd hardly walked off the dance floor when Emily was mobbed. It was Daniel Pivo who she went back out onto the dance floor with. Grover made his way through the crowd to the punch bowl. "Emily looks absolutely beautiful," Miss Snyder said, ladling punch into a cup and handing it to him. "You two make a handsome couple, Grover." Grover couldn't get near Emily for the rest of the first half of the dance. At the break, Emily came up, grabbed his hand, and started to lead him out through the gym door, but stopped when Mrs. Dillingham came up. "Emily," she said, "so good to see you. How's school up in Bakersville?" Emily shrugged. "I miss Claxton." "Well, you're welcome any time," she said. Then she turned to Grover. "I had no idea you were such a Fred Astaire, Grover." When Mrs. Dillingham disappeared into the crowd, Emily motioned Grover to follow her through the gym door and into the lobby. Checking to make sure no one saw them, they passed the one-room infirmary, Miss Snyder's office, and Mrs. Dillingham's office. They hurried past the cafeteria, where they heard teachers and volunteer mothers preparing trays of food. They walked quickly up to the second floor and then to the third. Their footsteps echoed down the hallway. They had the whole third floor to themselves. "I don't think we're supposed to be up here," Grover whispered. Emily tried Mrs. Caswell's door and found it unlocked. "What are we doing?" Grover asked. She opened the door and went inside, and after a minute he followed her. She turned on the lights, and they walked up and down the rows of empty desks. Emily sat in her old desk, and he sat in his. The radiators knocked and hissed. "Claxton feels different at night." Emily walked to the front of the room, tracing her finger across Mrs. Caswell's desk. Heavy footsteps came down the hall. Grover turned off the lights, and they crouched by the door, peeking through the window that looked out onto the hall. The footsteps were getting louder. Emily pulled Grover down beside her, and they both crouched underneath the window, praying it wasn't Mrs. Caswell. The footsteps passed, and they peeked through the window to see the back of Miss Shook. They heard her stomp into a classroom next door, rummage around, and then come back out and walk past them again. She carried a stapler. They crouched at the door until they couldn't hear her footsteps any more. "We ought to get out of here before somebody catches us," he said. Emily had walked over to the row of windows that looked outside. "Nobody else will come," she said. "Look." He got up, and glancing back toward the door, walked over to her. Out the window, they could see downtown laid out before them, the glowing street lights, the warm squares of window light from apartments, stores, and restaurants, and the winking Christmas lights the city had wound around and up into the trees. "It's like there's light coming up from underneath the city," Grover said. leaking out from all the windows. It looks incandescent, Emily said. That was the word, Grover thought. Incandescent was the word he'd been trying to think of when he'd been thinking of how Emily looked tonight in her dress. "Who's Fred Astaire?" Grover asked. "A famous dancer," Emily said. "He's in old movies my grandmother likes." They heard Mr. Godlewski's band start up somewhere down below. "We better go," Grover said. "Just a minute more." Emily reached for his hand and turned back to the window. He stood there looking down on a place he'd lived all his life, but until tonight had never really seen. Emily was mobbed by boys. Grover watched her waltz away with Morgan King, a stout, red-faced boy who could beat anybody in the 100-yard dash. When the waltz was over, Grover climbed the steps to the stage and found Mr. Godlewski tuning his bass. "Mr. Godlewski, can your band play the Tennessee Waltz?" he asked. Mr. Godlewski looked at the other men tuning their instruments. "What do you think, boys?" "If I can remember how it goes," said the bald fat man who played the fiddle. He scratched his head. "Yeah, if we can remember how it goes," said the long-faced piano player who stroked his chin. They were fighting off smiles. "We'll save it for the last," Mr. Godlewski said. "That'll be a good one to go out on." "If we can remember how it goes," said the fiddle player. The three men laughed as Grover headed back down. For the rest of the evening, Grover couldn't get near Emily for everybody wanting to dance with her. Mira tapped his shoulder, smiling. "You've caught on quick," Mira said, as they waltzed around the room. "Dancing with girls is better than dancing with Chris Norris or Bill Parks." She threw back her head and laughed. When she did, he glimpsed the pink of her tongue and the red of her throat, and it made something stir below, a stiffness that he'd been feeling more often. Luckily, the waltzing helped it go back down. Grover waltzed with a couple of other girls, but mostly he stood by the punch bowl, watching Emily waltz. Sam came up to him. "How'd you get away from Ashley?" Grover asked. "Told her I was going to the bathroom," he said, looking over his shoulder. "Why don't you dance with somebody else?" Grover asked. "I don't feel like it," Sam said. "You like Ashley," Grover said accusingly. "What if I do?" "She is pretty," Grover said, "when you subtract her personality." Sam saw Ashley coming toward him and darted off toward the boys' bathroom. After a couple more waltzes, Mr. Godlewski stepped up to the microphone. "Ladies and gentlemen, we'll wind up the 89th Isaac Claxton Christmas Waltz with a special request." Grover made his way across the crowded gym floor in the direction of Emily. The band played the melody a couple of times through, and then Mr. Godlewski stepped up to the microphone and started singing in his high, nasally voice. Grover needn't have worried about Mr. Godlewski knowing the words. He sang it like he'd sang it hundreds of times before, like the words were part of him. It was a song about someone remembering the night of a dance when he lost his girlfriend to an old friend he'd introduced her to. As Mr. Godlewski sang, Grover imagined Emily as a little girl riding her father's feet, squealing and laughing while he danced her around the grandmother's cabin. Then he thought how neither father nor daughter could have known what was coming to change everything. Even good memories had a sadness to them because they were memories. After Mr. Godlewski had sung the song through one time, he stepped back from the microphone and rejoined the band as they played through the melody again. Grover dodged through the dancing couples, but didn't see Emily anywhere. He was running out of time. The song would be over before he could get to her. Someone tapped him on the shoulder. Emily held out her arms, and they began to waltz. As they danced around the gym floor, Grover saw her eyes were glistening. "Thank you," she said. They danced around the gym floor, having to go much slower with all the couples crowding the floor. Mr. Godlewski stepped up to the microphone and sang the song again. This time, he sang it a little slower, a little sadder, and Grover thought it was one of the most beautiful songs he'd ever heard. As Mr. Godlewski sang the words, "Now I know just how much I have lost," Grover looked into Emily's eyes, thinking about this girl who, after the Christmas waltz, would be gone. But the dancing didn't let him stay in his head. The weight of Emily in his arms as they circled the floor, the press of her back against his hand, the warmth of her other hand in his, all kept him firmly in the gym. Moving across the crowded floor, Grover felt more with her than he'd ever felt. What wonderful music! Mrs. Dillingham had climbed on stage and was speaking into the microphone. "Please join me in giving Buncombe Turnpike a hand." The gym thundered with applause and whistles as Mr. Godlewski and the other men bowed. Grover and Emily stood looking at each other. Then they started out of the gym together and into the lobby, where parents were waiting to pick up their kids. "Doesn't Sis look like a movie star?" Clay said, coming up. "There they are." Leela gave Grover a hug. "Don't you look handsome?" "How's the bamboo forest?" Clay asked. "Any new weavings?" "A few," Grover said. "A few?" Sudie had walked in with their father. "He's made a whole hallway." Sudie and Clay moved off by themselves, talking a mile a minute. Their father talked to several parents in the crowd, and then made his way over to them. Their father stopped smiling when he saw Leela, and Leela did the same. "I didn't know y'all were coming," their father said to Leela. "Emily promised Grover," Leela said. "It's good to see you," their father said to Leela. "Sorry we missed y'all when you came up to Rowan Mountain," she said. "We were already up that way getting a tree," his father said. "You'll have to bring the kids up again," Leela said. "Maybe they could spend a night with us." Leela looked at their father, then looked away. "Well, I guess we better get on back up the mountain." "Right," his father said. "Could we go for hot chocolate?" Clay asked. "I've got to get up pretty early tomorrow," Leela said. "Come on, Mama," Clay said. "Can't we visit a little bit?" "I'm not even sure where we could get hot chocolate this time of night," their father said. "Bean Streets," Sudie said. "What do you think, Leela?" their father asked. Leela glanced at Clay and Emily, then looked back at their father. "Oh, I guess it wouldn't hurt to get back a little later." "Yes," Clay said. "But we can't stay long," she said. They started out the front door, but Emily stopped. "My coat." "I'll get it." Grover trotted back into the gym. Most of the kids were gone. Miss Snyder, Mrs. Dillingham, and a couple of teachers were carrying food and punch back to the kitchen. Mr. Godlewski and his band were packing up. Grover found Emily's coat draped over the same chair he'd put it on. He was heading back when he spotted Sam leaning against the wall. "Where's Ashley?" Grover asked. Sam nodded toward the girls' restroom. She went in there with a couple of her friends. "What all do girls do in the restroom, anyway?" Grover shrugged. "I can't believe Emily came all the way down from Bakersville to dance with you," Sam said. "I saw you dance with Mira a couple of times, too. You danced with the two prettiest girls in the whole place." Sam nodded at the coat in Grover's hands. "That's Emily's, isn't it?" "We're going to Bean Streets with her family," Grover said. Sam put his hand on Grover's shoulder. "When it comes to advice about girls, next time I'm coming to you." They heard girls' voices coming out of the bathroom. Uh-oh, Sam said. See you later, Grover said. Have fun for the both of us, Sam called after him. Just before the gym door closed after him, Grover heard Ashley say, What was that supposed to mean, Sam? Don't you have fun with me? You better have fun with me. Bean Streets was so crowded that after they got their hot chocolates, they had to wait for tables to clear. A good many people were dressed up like they'd been to a concert or a play. Some Claxton kids from the Christmas Waltz were there with their parents. Then there were the usual hippie-ish, tattooed, dreadlocked, quasi-street people whose dogs tied up outside pawed at the window. Grover couldn't walk into Bean Streets anymore without checking for Matthew. In fact, he couldn't go by Riverside or ride the bus downtown or even walk down his street without checking for him. He hadn't seen him once since the night his father had told him Matthew had been the driver. It made him wonder if somehow Matthew knew he knew and was avoiding him. Why don't the kids sit there? Their father said to Leela, as a table of four women got up to leave. We can sit over there. He pointed to a table for two by the window. So Grover, Sudie, Emily, and Clay sat at their own table. Grover and Emily ended up sitting in such a way that they could see their father and Leela across the room from them. Sudie and Clay sat with their backs to their parents. The four of them talked for a while, but then Grover began watching his father and Leela, even though they were too far away to hear what they were saying. For a long time, his father and Leela hadn't talked at all. They mostly looked out the window and sipped on their hot chocolate. We miss y'all, Sudie said. The neighborhood isn't the same. Nothing against Bakersville, Clay said. Just feels kind of on the slow side after living in Asheville, doesn't it, sis? Emily nodded, but was also keeping an eye on Leela and their father, who talked some now, but didn't smile. I'm a city boy at heart, Clay said, looking around at all the people in Bean Streets. Grover and Emily glanced at each other. Something was being decided in the conversation between their parents. Leela's eyes had reddened, and their father looked down, tracing his finger around his cup. The more he watched them not talking, not smiling, not offering the least glimmer of hope, the angrier Grover felt. Mr. Lunsford says he's cutting down the bamboo forest, Sudie said. He can't do that, Clay said. Daddy says it's his land and he can do what he wants with it. Grover, Emily said. Grover looked away from their parents and tried to focus on Emily. You didn't tell me about Mr. Lunsford, Emily said. What's there to tell? Grover said, trying to hold back the anger in his words. I'm your friend, Emily said. So? Grover said, feeling his face heat up. I'd want to know something like that, she said. It's the end of everything, okay? Grover said, hearing himself shout. It's the end of everything, and there's nothing you or anybody else can do about it. Bean Streets grew quiet, except for a couple of the street people who laughed about something. Grover ran out the front door and started down Biltmore Avenue, hands thrust deep in his coat pockets. Grover, his father called. Grover heard footsteps come up beside him. Then he felt a hand on his shoulder, stopping him. What in the world was that all about? His father said, catching his breath. Grover shook his head and started walking again. His father followed after him, walking along beside him. Did Emily say something, or Clay? I don't want to talk about it, Grover said. Was it something I did? His father asked. Grover stopped. I don't know what it is. All I know is that for a little while tonight, everything was okay. In fact, everything was really good. And then all of a sudden, everything wasn't, and talking about it won't help, Grover said, and started walking again. Talking about things just makes them worse. His father walked with Grover, but didn't say anything else. As they walked through downtown, Grover was vaguely aware of the brightly colored lights outlining buildings and hanging in storefronts. Christmas decorations made him feel left out. "Daddy," Grover said, "if you like Leela, then do something about it." They walked along for a little bit. "Isn't it too soon?" their father asked. "It'll always be too soon," Grover said. "Won't it be strange for you and Sudi?" their father asked. "Of course," Grover said. After they'd walked 3 or 4 blocks, Grover began to calm down. He remembered his sister. "Where's Sudi?" "The Round Trees were going to drop her by Jesse's on their way back up the mountain," he said. Grover felt foolish for ending the evening the way he had. The Round Trees had gone back up the mountain, probably for good, and he hadn't even said goodbye. By the time Grover and his father walked across downtown, Grover felt too tired to be upset. His father must have sensed the change, because when they turned a corner and found a city bus idling there with the door open, his father put his hand on Grover's shoulder and said, "How about we ride the rest of the way home?" Cold and tired, Grover nodded, and together they climbed into the light and the warmth of the bus. They were the only passengers. His father dropped change into the change counter. Grover always liked the sound of the coins tinkling against the glass. They sat a couple of seats behind the driver, a gray-haired man. The driver closed the door and pulled out into traffic. After a while, the bus driver looked up at them in his rearview mirror and said, "How y'all tonight?" "Better," his father said, "now that we're on your bus and out of the cold." He patted Grover's knee. "I know that's right," the bus driver said. Grover yawned. "Grover," his father said, "I want you to know that you don't ever have to take care of me, at least till it's time for the old folks home." "Okay, Daddy," he said, as if all the night's events suddenly caught up with him. Grover felt exhausted. The bus rounded a corner, leaning him against his father. But even when the bus straightened out, he let his head stay on his father's shoulder. Chapter 20. Bad News. Saturday, Grover spent all morning in his workshop, remembering his father's warning to check for Mr. Lunsford's car. As usual, Sudi had come with him and was a lookout. Mr. Lunsford hadn't returned to the bamboo forest, at least as far as Grover could tell. Jesse, who'd come down a couple of times to walk through the hallway again, said Mr. Lunsford had always been a little afraid of their father. Grover had continued to work hard, knowing it was only a matter of time, weeks or even days, before Mr. Lunsford had the bamboo forest leveled. He felt like the man in The Pit and the Pendulum, a story that Mrs. Caswell had had them read. The blade lowering, getting closer and closer. He could almost hear it. Wanting to make the most of the time he had left, he'd been working on his biggest weaving yet. 12 feet wide and 7 feet tall, the size of a small billboard. He'd had to haul a stepladder into the bamboo forest to be able to weave in limbs high enough. At lunchtime, Sudi brought him a peanut butter and honey sandwich so he could keep working. After lunch, Grover had just gotten started back working on the big weaving when Sudi called to him, "Someone's coming." Grover started down the ladder. "Never mind," Sudi called. "It's just Jesse." Grover climbed back up the ladder. "But he's bringing some people with him," Sudi called. Grover jumped down off the ladder and ran to where Sudi sat on a rock, looking through their father's birding binoculars. "You're never going to believe this." She handed him the binoculars, and when he finally focused on the group, he saw that Jesse was leading Mrs. Caswell, Miss Snyder, and Mrs. Dillingham straight to the bamboo forest. "Why is he bringing them?" Grover whispered. Sooty was already racing out of the bamboo forest to meet them. She ran up and gave Miss Snyder a hug. Grover ran back to the workshop, packed up his tools, then, grabbing up his toolbox, started to make a run for it. But when he turned around, Jessie and the three women were there, looking at the big half-finished weaving behind him. "Oh, my Lord," Mrs. Caswell said, walking up to it and lightly touching it. "Goodness," Miss Snyder said, looking at Grover and then back at the weaving. "Astonishing," Mrs. Dillingham said. "I brought these ladies over to get a look at your work," Jessie said. Grover nodded, but didn't really understand. "Sooty," Jessie said, "why don't you show them Grover's gallery?" "Sure," Sooty said. "This way." She showed them the entrance to the hallway, and the three women disappeared down the passageway with Sooty. Grover could hear them oohing and aahing as they went deeper into the gallery. At one point, he heard Mrs. Dillingham exclaim, "Miraculous!" "I'm sorry to surprise you like this," Jessie said in a low voice to Grover. "I figured you wouldn't let me bring them if I told you ahead of time." "Why?" Grover asked, feeling angry. "People need to know what you're doing back here," Jessie said. "But why'd you bring them?" Grover whispered. These were the last people on earth he'd ever want back here. His teacher, his counselor, his principal, and it wasn't even a school day. "For one thing, I do their yards, and I've been telling them about your weavings for a while, and with Lunsford about to do away with the place..." A flock of crows passed overhead, making a loud racket and settling on the far edge of the bamboo. "You know when he's cutting it down?" Grover asked. Jessie sighed. "I ran into a fellow yesterday, walking around the edge of the bamboo forest. He told me Lunsford had hired him to clear this all out." "Did he say when?" Grover asked, his heart feeling suddenly hollow. Jessie looked at the ground. "Day after tomorrow." "Monday?" Grover sat down on the big stump in the center of his workshop. "I asked him if he'd mind giving me a call as soon as he was sure what time of day he'd be clearing it." Jessie sat down next to Grover. After a little while, the women emerged with Sooty from the hallway. They surrounded him. "What you've done here is remarkable," Mrs. Dillingham said. "I'd heard about your weavings," Miss Snyder said, "but I'd had no idea." "This is important work, Grover," Mrs. Caswell said. "People need to see this." "Indeed," said Mrs. Dillingham. Grover only half heard the women as he sat on the stump, looking around at the bamboo forest. Monday, it would be gone. As the women left, Jessie said he'd go with them, that he needed to get back to work. Sooty followed them out, then returned in a minute and found Grover still sitting on the stump. "I'm not working any more," he said. "You mean today?" "Ever." "Why not?" "They're cutting it down on Monday." "Oh," she said, sitting down on the stump beside him. They were quiet for a little while. Finally, Sooty said, "You need to finish this one." She nodded at the giant, half-done weaving. "What does it matter, Sooty?" he snapped. "I've been working on these weavings for weeks, and I've been working in the bamboo forest nearly all my life, and it's all going to be gone in a couple of days." "You have the rest of today and tomorrow," she said. "Finish it." He pushed himself up off the stump. "I have to go someplace," he said. "Can I come?" "No." "Come on, Biscuit," she said, sounding hurt. "Sesame Street's on." She stomped out of the bamboo forest. Grover waited to be sure Sooty was gone, then headed up the street and turned in at Riverside. He hadn't visited his mother's grave in a while. The tapestries he'd made for her had all but fallen apart. The leaves and limbs had mostly disintegrated. Mainly what was left were the sturdy bamboo grids, tapestry skeletons. Grover sat down on a little wall and faced her headstone. He'd been thinking a lot lately about a night just a few days before she died. It had been a Friday night. Their father had had to stay late at the Wolf House, and Sudie was spending the night up the street at Grace's. Grover and his mother had eaten supper, and Grover was headed out the door. "I'm going up the street," he'd said. Sam had a new video game he wanted to show him. "I was thinking we might play a game," his mother said. "Like what?" "Anything but Candyland." Candyland was the main game little kids wanted to play in her office. "I told Sam I'd come up after supper," he said. "How about checkers?" she asked. "Or Monopoly? That takes so long." "Scrabble?" "I'm terrible at Scrabble." "What about chess?" "Let's play chess. Come on, Grover. I play games all day, but I never get to really try." She started to get the chess set out of the game cabinet. "I told Sam I'd come up," Grover said. What he didn't say was that Sam had been telling him about his new Minesweeper video game all week. The other thing was that lately Grover had found his parents more and more boring. The idea of playing a game with his mother on a Friday night when he could be up the street with his friend made him feel trapped. Grover had walked up the street to Sam's that evening, glad to be out of the house and headed toward his friend's. If only he'd known, he would have played every single game in that cabinet with her. He thought about his father. He thought about Sudie. Even Jesse. What if something happened to one of them? What wasn't he doing with them now that he would regret later? Life, he was beginning to understand, was one long last chance. Grover was walking out of the cemetery when he saw Matthew raking up around some very old headstones in the Jewish section. At the sight of him, Grover felt a bolt of anger streak through him. He charged over to him. "I know about you," Grover said. Matthew stopped raking, pushed his glasses back on his nose, and leaned on the rake as if he'd been expecting Grover. "I know about you looking after Mama's grave," Grover said. "About you repairing my workshop. About you helping me get Emily out of the burning house." With each thing he listed, Grover heard himself become angrier, and I know why. Matthew looked at him calmly. "My father told me you were the driver," Grover said. "He said it wasn't your fault." "He didn't tell you everything," Matthew said matter-of-factly. "Everything?" Using the rake, Matthew picked up a handful of leaves and twigs, putting them into the wheelbarrow he'd been filling. "I had been answering my cell phone." "What are you talking about?" "I glanced down at my phone to see who was calling, and when I looked back, your mother was right there in front of the car." He motioned, as if looking through the windshield at her. Grover felt ambushed by this news. All he'd ever heard from his father, his friends, even the article that had run in the paper, was that the driver, who the paper had not named, wasn't at fault. "I can't help thinking, if I hadn't taken my eyes off the road..." "Did you tell the police?" Grover asked, his throat tightening. "I told the police. I told your father. I told anybody who would listen. They all said the same thing, that I would have hit her anyway. They all said no one could have stopped in time." "You told my father?" Grover asked. "He wouldn't press charges." Matthew sounded as if he'd wanted his father to press charges. "You looked down at your cell phone?" "I did. And then your car hit my mother." "Yes." Disturbed by something, a flock of crows erupted from a nearby tree, cawing loudly as they settled into a hemlock halfway across the cemetery. "I haven't driven since the accident," Matthew said, "and will never own another cell phone as long as I live." "Why tell me this?" Grover asked. I knew you wouldn't be afraid.
Afraid?
The way I see it, Matthew said, putting another handful of leaves in the wheelbarrow, my only chance of moving on is to tell the person who is likely to hate me the most. He glanced at Grover. Grover just stood there, taking in the cemetery. The headstones and monuments came into such sharp focus, it almost hurt to look at them. And there it was, the something else that had been weaving itself into his feelings since the day of the accident, almost without him knowing. "I'm to blame," Grover heard himself say, but he no more understood his words than if a stranger had spoken them.
"For what?" Matthew asked.
Grover felt a wall give way inside himself. If I had gone to get the movie at Video Life like she'd ask, she wouldn't have gone on that walk, he said. She wouldn't have been on Charlotte Street with the dog in the first place. This unthought had been lying unspoken, hidden inside himself like a copperhead curled up in a Christmas tree. A police car pulled into the gates, its blue lights silently swirling, and for a nanosecond Grover thought they'd come for him. But then came a hearse and a few solemn cars, their headlights shining. A funeral procession. Usually the lines of cars were much longer. The line for his mother's funeral had been too long to fit into the cemetery. People had had to park throughout the neighborhood. "You don't have to do this," Matthew said, as he watched the line of cars wind along the far side of the cemetery and disappear over a hill.
"Do what?" Grover asked.
"Try to make me feel better."
"Why would I care how you feel?" Grover snapped. "You killed our mother."
Matthew's eyes widened, and it appeared to Grover that he almost smiled. "I've about finished up here." The way Matthew looked around Riverside, Grover thought he meant he'd finished up at the cemetery. "I graduated," he said. "I'll be heading out in a couple of days."
"Good," Grover said, feeling confused and angry, and something else he didn't have a name for.
Having remembered one person's feelings he did care about, Grover began to trot up the little road. He happened to glance back and saw that Matthew had set his rake down and taken out a little notebook. He was bent beside a couple of headstones, scribbling away as if the dead were dictating to him. Sudie was sitting on the couch with Biscuit beside her, watching Nova, when Grover walked in and turned off the TV.
"Hey, I was watching that," Sudie said, clearly still mad.
"I have to finish that big weaving, and I need your help."
"You were snotty," she said, staring at the dark TV screen. "You've been snotty a lot lately."
Frowning, she pet Biscuit.
"I'm sorry," he said, sitting down on the couch beside her.
"It's just that with the bamboo forest about to be..."
"Listen, just because you're not happy doesn't give you the right to make other people unhappy," she said, looking up at him.
"I don't need help being sad." Her eyes reddened.
"But I need help finishing the big weaving."
She stared at the blank TV screen.
"Please," he said, petting Biscuit, "I can't finish it without you."
This reading of What I Came to Tell You by Tommy Hayes will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina.